Imagine the scenario. You're working triage in a busy ER. It's just a chaotic Tuesday night. The sliding doors burst open and a patient rushes in. They're visibly panicked. They're hyperventilating, holding their hand really tight over their face.
Okay, I'm with you.
A coworker helps them into a chair. You walk over, you gently pull their hand away to assess the injury, and you look at their face. There's a piece of wood, a splinter, but a large, jagged one sticking directly out of their eyeball.
Ooh, that is a visceral image. It triggers a very primal reaction in anyone, even seasoned nurses. Makes your own eyes water just thinking about it.
It does, and your heart starts racing. Your human instinct, the instinct that probably brought you into nursing in the first place, is to help. You want to clean it up. You want to fix it. You want to get that foreign object out of there so they can blink, so the pain stops. You reach for the tweezers or the saline flush.
And that is exactly the moment you fail the safety check.
Yeah.
That is the trap.
The instinct is wrong.
In this specific case, that instinct is dangerous. If you touch that object, if you try to remove it, you could be uncorking the pressure that is keeping the eye's contents inside.
You mean, like, literally the eye could deflate?
You could cause the vitreous humor to leak out, effectively collapsing the eye and blinding that patient permanently. The NCLEX answer, the only safe answer, is do not touch it.
Stabilize it.
Stabilize it. And call the ophthalmologist immediately.
It sounds so counterintuitive, but that's why we're here. Welcome to ConceptCast, brought to you by nursingnotes.org. I'm your host, here to ask the questions that every student is thinking but might be afraid to ask.
And I'm here to help you filter through the noise. We aren't just memorizing lists today. We are looking for the safety signals. Today, we are doing a deep dive into adult eye and ear disorders.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate for a second. When students are prepping for their boards, they're obsessing over the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, you know, the big organs that keep you alive.
Right, the core systems.
Eyes and ears. Is this really high yield? Can't I just focus on the life and death stuff and maybe, you know, skim the sensory chapter?
You could, but you'd be missing two very important things. First, you'd be missing easy points on the exam, because these questions are highly predictable if you know the rules.
Okay, easy points are good.
But more importantly, you'd be missing a massive component of patient safety. Eye and ear disorders aren't just about needing glasses or a hearing aid. They are about sensory perception.
Sensory perception.
Think about it. If a patient can't see the stairs, they fall and break a hip. If they can't hear the fire alarm or the instructions on how to take their insulin, they're in mortal danger.
So it's not just about the organ itself. It's about how that organ allows the patient to navigate the world safely.
Precisely. The NCLEX loves to test your ability to keep these patients safe in an unsafe world. So our mission today is to break down the pathophysiology you actually need to know. Not the fluff, but the mechanics.
I like that.
We're going to look for the red flag assessments.
Yeah.
And the very specific post-op teaching points that examiners return to again and again.
I like the sound of that. Let's move beyond just rote memorization and try to understand the why.
The why is the key. When you understand why a medication works or why a certain position is dangerous based on gravity and pressure, you don't have to memorize a list.
It just clicks.
It just makes sense mechanically. It sticks in your brain.
Let's make it make sense. We're going to start with the eyes. And looking at the data, we had to start with the big one, the silent thief of sight, glaucoma.
Glaucoma is a major topic. It's a leading cause of blindness worldwide, and it's heavily tested because it's preventable if caught early, but irreversible if missed.
Okay.
Fundamentally, glaucoma is a group of ocular diseases resulting in increased intraocular pressure, or IOP.
Okay, let's unpack that concept. Increased IOP, to me that sounds like an inflation problem, like a tire with way too much air in it.
That's close, but I prefer a plumbing analogy. It helps with understanding the medications later. Think of the eye as a kitchen sink.
A kitchen sink. Okay, I'm picturing it.
In this sink, you have a faucet that is constantly running, that represents the ciliary body in the eye. It's constantly producing a fluid called aqueous humor.
Aqueous humor. And it's important.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
This fluid is essential. It nourishes the front of the eye and maintains its shape.
So the water's always running. We can't turn the main line off.
Always running. And in a functioning kitchen, you have a drain, right? Mm-hmm. In the eye, that drain is the trabecular meshwork and the canal of Schlemm.
Okay, a very specific drain.
Right. And in a healthy eye, the amount of water coming out of the faucet exactly matches the amount of water going down the drain. The pressure stays stable.
Equilibrium. Input equals output.
Exactly. And we can measure that pressure. This is a number you absolutely need to know for the NCLEX. The normal range for intraocular pressure is typically between 10 and 21 millimeters of mercury.
10 to 21. Got it. I'm noting that down. That seems like a pretty tight range.
It is.
So what goes wrong in glaucoma?
The drain gets clogged.
Simple as that.
The faucet is still running. The fluid is still being produced, but it can't get out fast enough. This thing fills up. But unlike a kitchen sink where the water just spills onto the floor, the eye is a closed, rigid sphere. It can't expand.
Okay, so there's no overflow valve?
None. So as that fluid builds up, the pressure inside rises.
And since the eye can't expand outward like a balloon, that pressure has to go somewhere.
It pushes backward. And what is sitting right at the back of the eye, connecting it to the brain?
The optic nerve.
The optic nerve. The pressure compresses the delicate nerve fibers and the blood vessels supplying them. It essentially strangles the optic nerve.
Strangles it. That's a strong word.
It's accurate. And here's the scary part. Nerve tissue in the central nervous system generally does not regenerate. Once those fibers die, they're gone. That vision loss is permanent.
That creates a real sense of urgency. Now, the literature mentions two main types of glaucoma. Are they treated differently?
Oh, very differently. You must be able to distinguish between them, because one is a chronic condition and the other is a full-blown medical emergency.
Okay.
First, let's talk about primary open-angle glaucoma, or POAG.
POAG. This is the common one, right?
Yes. This accounts for the vast majority of cases, probably 90%. Going back to our sink analogy, imagine the drain is just slowly getting gunked up with hair and grease over 20 years.
Ugh. Okay.
It's still draining, but it's sluggish. The water level, the pressure rises very, very gradually.
Because it's so gradual, does the patient notice it happening?
Usually, no. That's why we call it the silent thief. It is painless. The patient doesn't feel the pressure building. They might not notice any vision change until significant damage is already done.
What does that damage look like? If they did notice it, what would they see?
It eats away at the peripheral vision first, the side vision.
So they start getting tunnel vision.
They develop tunnel vision, exactly. They can see clearly straight ahead, but they start bumping into door frames or missing cars coming from the side when they're driving.
That's terrifying, because by the time you realize you have tunnel vision, you've already lost a huge amount of optic nerve function.
Exactly. And because it's painless, compliance with treatment is a major nursing challenge.
I can see that.
If I give you a pill for a headache and your headache goes away, you're motivated to take it. But if I tell you to put drops in your eyes every day for the rest of your life for a disease you can't feel and doesn't hurt.
People forget. Or they think they're cured because they don't feel sick anymore.
Right. So the teaching point is, this is not curable. It is manageable. Lifelong medication is required to prevent blindness.
And it's not about making their vision better.
No. You aren't taking the drops to improve your vision. You're taking them to keep the vision you have left.
That's a really important distinction to make with patients.
Crucial.
Okay, so that's open angle, slow, painless tunnel vision. Now, what is the scenario where the patient comes in screaming?
That is primary angle closure glaucoma, or PETC. This is the medical emergency. In this case, it's not a slow clog. It's like someone threw a stopper in the sink while the faucet is on full blast.
What causes the stopper? What's happening anatomically?
Usually it's the iris, the colored part of the eye. For various anatomical reasons, the iris can bunch up or get pushed forward and it physically blocks the drainage angle. The outflow just stops completely.
And the pressure spikes instantly.
Rapidly. It can go from normal, 15 to 50 or 60 millimeter HG very, very quickly.
Wow.
The symptoms are dramatic. The patient will complain of sudden excruciating eye pain. It's often described as a boring pain, like a drill going into the eye.
And I see here in the notes that nausea is common.
Yes. The pain is so visceral, it triggers a vagal response. Nausea and vomiting are very common. They will also report visual disturbances, specifically seeing halos around lights.
Halos? Like in a painting?
Exactly. If they look at a street lamp, they see a rainbow ring around it. That's caused by the corneal edema from the high pressure.
So sudden severe pain, nausea, and halos, that is a drop everything moment.
It is. If that pressure isn't relieved within hours, permanent blindness can occur. This requires immediate intervention.
So how do we treat this? If it's a plumbing problem, I assume we either turn off the faucet or we force the drain open.
That is exactly how the pharmacology works. We attack it from both sides. Let's look at the drain openers first. These are the miotics.
Miotics. I always get this confused with midriatics.
A lot of people do. A miotic drug is something like pilocarpine. The name tells you what they do if you know your roots. Miosis means pupil constriction.
A useful trick I've heard is Meiotix has a C for constrict. Or maybe little word, little pupil.
Little word, little pupil works well. Compare meiotic to midriatic. Meiotic is the shorter word. It makes the pupil small. Midriatic is the longer word. It makes the pupil big.
Okay, so why do we want a small pupil in glaucoma? How does that help?
Think about the anatomy of the iris. When the pupil is dilated or big, the iris is kind of bunched up into the corners, potentially blocking the drain.
Like a curtain getting bunched up in a window frame.
Perfect analogy. When you constrict the pupil, make it small, you are stretching the iris out flat, pulling it away from the drainage angle.
Ah, so constricting the pupil physically pulls the blockage away from the drain. It unclogs the sink.
Exactly. It opens up that trabecular meshwork. So palocarpine is a go-to for opening the flow.
Okay. Now, what about the other side, turning off the faucet?
For that, we use beta blockers. Drugs like Temolol or Betaxolol.
I usually associate beta blockers with blood pressure and heart rates, the LOL drugs.
And they work on the same beta receptors, just located in the ciliary body of the eye. They decrease the production of aqueous humor. They literally turn down the faucet.
But here's a safety question. If I'm putting a beta blocker in my eye, do I need to worry about my heart?
This is a huge testing point. Yes, you absolutely do.
It's just a drop.
Even though it's a topical drop, it can be absorbed systemically. It drains down the tear duct into the nose and then into the vascular system.
So a patient could get bradycardia or low blood pressure from an eye drop.
Absolutely. Or if they're asthmatic, a non-selective beta blocker like Timolol can cause bronchoconstriction. You could trigger an asthma attack with an eye drop.
That seems like a massive risk. How do we prevent it?
There is a specific technique called punctal occlusion.
Punctal occlusion. Break that down for us.
It sounds fancy, but it's simple. When you administer the drop, you or the patient presses firmly on the inner canthus, the corner of the eye next to the nose.
Okay.
You hold that pressure for 30 to 60 seconds.
You're physically pinching off the tear duct.
Correct. You are blocking the opening to the drainage system. This keeps the medication in the eye where it's needed and stops it from draining down into the systemic circulation.
That is a vital skill. So for any patient with heart block, bradycardia, or asthma, punctal occlusion isn't just a suggestion, it's a safety requirement.
It's a must do.
Yeah.
Correct. Now, we talked about meiotics making the pupil small. We need to talk about the opposite. Midriatics.
Drugs like atropine. They dilate the pupil.
Big word, big pupil. Here's the golden rule for glaucoma.
Yeah.
Avoid atropine.
Because if you dilate the pupil,
you bunch up the iris. You block the angle. If you give atropine to a patient with glaucoma, you can trigger an acute angle closure attack.
Yeah.
You can cause the emergency we are trying to prevent.
So if I'm on the unit and I see a patient has a history of glaucoma and there is an order for atropine for, say, pre-op.
You hold the med. You call the provider. You do not give it. That is a contraindication. You are the safety net.
Clear enough. Glaucoma. Pressure problem, meiotics good, atropine bad, watch the heart with beta blockers. Let's shift focus now to the lens, cataracts.
Cataracts are incredibly common. I mean, if you live long enough, you will likely get them.
Okay.
It is an opacity or clouding of the crystalline lens.
The lens is supposed to be clear to focus light, right? Like the lens on a camera.
Exactly. But with age, UV exposure, or conditions like diabetes, the proteins in the lens denature and clump together. It just gets cloudy.
What is the patient's experience with this? Is it painful?
No, and that's a key discriminator. Cataracts are painless. The patient complains of blurred vision, like looking through a dirty window or a piece of wax paper.
And I've heard about glare, too.
Yes, a very specific complaint is glare, especially at night.
Like oncoming headlights.
Yes. The cloudy lens scatters the light entering the eye, causing halos and starbursts around lights. It makes night driving very dangerous. They might also notice that colors look faded or yellowed.
So the fix is surgery. We take out the cloudy lens and put in a fresh artificial one.
Cataract extraction with intraocular lens implantation. It's one of the most common and successful surgeries in the world. But the post-op care is where the NCLEX questions live.
I'm going to guess, since we just cut into the eye, we're worried about pressure again.
Always. We have a healing incision. We do not want to put any stress on it. So the discharge instructions are all about avoiding activities that increase intraocular pressure.
Let's list the no-nos. What can't they do?
No bending over at the waist.
Why specifically at the waist?
When you bend your head below your waist, blood rushes to the head, increasing venous pressure, which in turn increases eye pressure. If they need to pick something up, they should bend at the knees, keeping the head upright.
Okay. Squat. Don't bend. What else?
No heavy lifting. Usually anything over 5 to 10 pounds is restricted. No lifting groceries, no picking up a grandchild,
Okay.
and no coughing or sneezing. If it can be helped, obviously that's difficult. But we teach them to sneeze with their mouth open to equalize pressure.
And the bathroom habits.
Yeah, this is huge. No straining at stool.
Yeah.
The Valsalva maneuver bearing down massively spikes head and eye pressure.
So we need to be proactive with constipation.
Aggressively proactive. Fluids, fiber, stool softeners. We do not want them straining on the toilet and popping their incision. That is a disaster.
Now, what about pain? You said cataracts themselves are painless, but surgery causes some trauma. What is normal post-op?
Mild scratchiness is normal. They might feel like there's sand in their eye. That's the incision healing.
Okay.
But, and this is the red flag, if the patient reports sudden severe pain.
It's not normal.
Not normal at all. Severe pain after cataract surgery usually indicates a complication, like a hemorrhage or a sudden pressure spike secondary glaucoma. If they call you with severe pain or nausea, you notify the surgeon immediately.
You don't just tell them to take a Tylenol.
You do not tell them to take a Tylenol and sleep it off.
That's a very clear distinction. Scratchy and sandy is okay. Deep severe pain is an emergency.
Correct.
Let's move to the back of the eye. Retinal detachment. This sounds catastrophic.
It is. The retina is the sensory layer, the wallpaper at the back of the eye that captures the image. It sits on top of the choroid, which is the vascular layer that feeds it.
Okay.
In a detachment, the wallpaper peels off the wall.
So the retina loses its blood supply?
Yes. It separates from the choroid. It's deprived of oxygen. If it's not reattached quickly, that retinal tissue dies and you get a permanent blind spot.
What does this look like to the patient? I've heard about flashes.
There are three classic signs you need to memorize. First, photopsia, or flashes of light. It looks like lightning streaks or camera flashes in the peripheral vision.
And that's happening because?
It happens because the retina is being tugged on. It's a mechanical stimulation of the photoreceptors.
Okay, flashes. What's number two?
Floaters. A sudden shower of black spots, cobwebs, or soot in the vision. This can be blood or pigment cells being released into the vitreous as the retina tears.
And the third?
The curtain. This is the classic description. As the retina peels off, the patient loses that part of their visual field. They will describe a shadow or a curtain falling over the top, bottom, or side of their vision. I can't see the top half of the room.
Is there pain?
No. The retina has no pain fibers. This is a painless loss of vision.
That's so deceptive. You'd think it doesn't hurt, so it can't be that bad.
Which is why recognizing the curtain and flashes is so critical. This is a time-sensitive emergency.
So what is the nursing priority? If a patient comes in saying this, what's my first move?
Immobilization. We need to stop the eye from moving. If the eye moves, the fluid inside sloshes around and can peel the retina off further.
How do you stop an eye from moving? You can't put a cast on it.
You put them on bed rest?
Yeah.
And you patch the eyes.
Both eyes. Even if only one is detached.
Yes. This is a concept called conjugate movement. Your eyes move together. If I leave your good eye open and you track a nurse walking across the room, your bad eye will automatically try to track with it. To stop one, you have to stop both.
That makes sense, but imagine the patient's experience. They are scared, they're losing their vision, and now you've blindfolded them completely.
It is terrifying. They are sensory deprived. So your role shifts to safety and reassurance. You become their eyes. You keep the call light in their hand. You orient them to the room. You speak before you touch them.
Now, I've read conflicting things about positioning for retinal detachment. Do we sit them up, lay them flat? What's the rule?
The rule is that there is no single rule.
Okay.
It depends entirely on where the tear is. And this is where you follow the provider's order strictly.
Oh.
The principle is gravity. We want to use gravity to push the retina back against the choroid wall.
So if the tear is at the bottom of the eye...
We don't want them sitting up because fluid would settle down and push the tear open. The provider will position the head so the detachment is dependent or at the lowest point, allowing a tamponade agent like a gas bubble injected during surgery to float up and press the retina flat.
So the takeaway is... There is no single correct position for all detachments. Check the order.
Exactly. Don't guess.
Let's transition to trauma. We started the show with the wood in the eye. That's a penetrating injury.
Right. And just to recap, never remove the object.
But we can't just leave it dangling. We have to stabilize it.
Yes. The paper cup shield is the classic field fix. You take a paper cup, cut the bottom out, and you tape it over the eye. The object sticks to the hole in the cup.
What does that achieve?
It creates a rigid barrier. If the patient bumps their face, the cup takes the impact, not the object. It prevents the object from being driven deeper into the brain or the eye.
Simple, effective. Now, what about chemical burns? Someone splashes bleach or battery acid or lime in their eye.
This is the one time you do not assess first. You act.
Don't check vision. Don't look for the bottle to see what it was.
Not yet. Seconds matter. You irrigate immediately. You grab the nearest water source. Saline is best, but a sink, a hose, a water bottle will do, and you flush that eye.
How long?
A long time. The standard is usually 15 to 20 minutes of continuous irrigation. You have to wash the chemical out and neutralize the pH.
Is there a difference between acid and alkali burns? I feel like there is.
Yes, and this is counterintuitive. Alkali burns, like from drain cleaners, lye, or ammonia, are actually worse than acid burns.
Really? I would have guessed acid.
Acids tend to sear the outer layer, creating a scab that kind of limits penetration. Alkali substances cause liquefaction necrosis. They melt through the tissue and penetrate deep into the eye very, very quickly. So for alkali burns, irrigation is even more critical.
And direction matters, right?
Inner to outer. You irrigate from the inner canthus, the nose side, to the outer canthus, the ear side.
Why?
Because if you go the other way, you wash the chemicals across the bridge of the nose and into the other eye. You want to wash it away from the face.
Got it. Inner to outer. 20 minutes. Then call a doctor.
Correct.
One more trauma term. Hyphema.
Hyphema is blood in the anterior chamber. That's the space between the cornea and the iris.
Okay.
It usually happens after blunt force, like getting hit with a baseball.
Yeah.
You can actually see a fluid line of blood at the bottom of the colored part of the eye.
Like a half-filled wine glass inside the eye.
That's a great visual.
Yeah.
The treatment here relies on gravity again. We place the patient in semi-Fowler's position head, elevated 30 to 45 degrees.
Why not flat?
If they lie flat, the blood spreads out over the whole pupil and it blocks their vision completely. It can also clog the trabecular meshwork, causing a secondary glaucoma.
Ah, okay.
But if they sit up, the blood settles to the bottom, clearing the visual axis.
So gravity is our friend in eye disorders.
It's all physics. Fluids, pressures, and gravity.
Let's switch gears. We've covered the eyes. Let's talk about the ears.
Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear. Hearing loss is a huge topic for the elderly population specifically. The NCLEX usually breaks this down into conductive versus sensorineural. I always mix these up.
Think of the anatomy as a pathway. The sound wave travels through the air, down the ear canal. It vibrates the eardrum and then moves through the tiny bones, the ossicles of the middle ear. All of that is conduction.
So it's just a mechanical process.
It's just mechanical vibration. So conductive hearing loss is a roadblock somewhere in that part of the path.
Okay, so something is physically blocking the sound?
Exactly. It could be a plug of earwax cerumen. It could be an infection filling the middle ear with pus, that's otitis media. It could be a hole in the eardrum.
So I stick my finger in my ear, I'm giving myself temporary conductive hearing loss.
Exactly. And the good news about conductive loss is that it's often correctable. Remove the wax, treat the infection, patch the drum, or use a hearing aid.
And hearing aids work well here.
They work very well here because they just act as an amplifier to punch the sound through the blockage.
Okay, so that's conductive. What is sensorineural?
This is deeper. The sound has reached the inner ear, the cochlea, but the wiring is broken.
The wiring?
The hair cells in the cochlea or the acoustic nerve, that's cranial nerve 8, are damaged.
This sounds more permanent.
It usually is. Once those nerve cells die, they don't regenerate. Causes include aging. We call that presbycusis, loud noise exposure, like working in a factory or rock concerts or ototoxic drugs.
Ototoxic drugs. The examiners love this list. Which drugs kill the ear?
The big guns of antibiotics. Aminoglycosides. These are the drugs ending in comycin or mancolson. Gentamicin, vancomycin, neomycin.
Vancomycin is everywhere in the hospital.
It is. Yeah. And another common one is high-dose aspirin salicylates or loop diuretics like furosemide Lasix if you push it too fast through an IV.
How do we know if damage is happening? Does the patient just suddenly go deaf?
Usually there is a warning sign. Tinnitus. Ringing in the ears.
So if my patient on gentamicin says, hey, my ears are ringing, that is a red flag.
That is a siren. It means toxicity is occurring. If you continue the drug, the hearing loss could become permanent. You need to notify the provider to check trough levels or change the med.
Okay. Conductive blockage. Sensorineural nerve wiring. Now let's talk about the specific type of hearing loss in the elderly. Presbycusis.
Presbycusis is age-related sensorineural loss. It's gradual, but there is a specific pattern to it. They lose the ability to hear high-pitched frequencies first.
So they lose the sound of birds chirping or the microwave beep.
And critically, they lose the voices of women and children. but even more importantly for communication, they lose the high-frequency consonant sounds in speech. Sounds like S, Z, T, F, G.
Why does that matter so much?
Vowels A, E, I, O, U are low-pitched. Consonants are high-pitched. Consonants give speech its crispness and its meaning. If you can only hear vowels, speech sounds like mumbling.
So the patient says, I can hear you talking, but I can't understand what you're saying.
Exactly. They accuse everyone of mumbling. Stop mumbling. Speak up.
Which brings us to the communication questions. When a patient says, speak up, our instinct is to shout.
And shouting is the worst thing you can do.
Why?
When you shout, you naturally raise the pitch of your voice. You scream in a higher frequency. You are shifting your voice right into the zone they can't hear.
So it just becomes painful noise.
It just sounds like painful, distorted noise. So shouting fails. What works?
Lower your tone.
Lower your tone. Speak in a normal volume, but a deeper pitch if you can. Speak slowly and clearly. And the number one rule, face the client.
Face them.
They need visual cues. They are lip reading more than they realize. If you talk while looking at the monitor or walking out the door, you're gone. Get their attention, face them, ensure light is on your face, and speak clearly.
That's actionable advice. Let's move to a disorder that affects both hearing and balance. Meniere's disease.
Meniere's is debilitating. It's a chronic condition of the inner ear caused by endolymphatic high drops.
Fancy words. Translate.
High drops just refers to water or fluid. Basically, there is too much fluid endolymph being produced or not absorbed in the inner ear labyrinth.
So the inner ear is bloated with fluid.
Right. And since the inner ear controls both hearing via the cochlea and balance via the vestibule, both systems go haywire.
Okay.
There is a classic triad of symptoms you must know.
What's the triad?
Number one, tinnitus, ringing. Number two, unilateral sensory neural hearing loss. One ear goes dead. Number three, vertigo.
Vertigo is the big one here.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's important to distinguish vertigo from just dizziness. Dizziness is, I feel lightheaded. Vertigo is, the room is spinning around me violently. It is a hallucination of motion. Mm-hmm. It causes severe nausea and vomiting. These attacks can last for hours or even days.
If the room is spinning, the patient can't walk.
No. So the priority nursing diagnosis is risk for injury or risk for falls. During intac, strict bed rest, side rails up, assistance to the bathroom, or better yet, a bedpan. Do not let them try to walk to the toilet alone. They will fall.
What about diet? I often see dietary restrictions for Meniere's.
Think about the cause. Fluid accumulation. We want to reduce fluid retention. What holds water in the body?
Sodium, salt.
Exactly. So a low sodium diet is crucial. We want to prevent fluid shifts. Avoid pickles, canned soups, processed meats, Chinese takeout.
So low salt, safety falls precautions. What meds do we use?
We treat the symptoms. Antiemetics like promethazine for the vomiting. Antihistamines like meclizine brand name, Antivert. This is specific for vertigo because it suppresses the vestibular system. And sometimes diuretics to pull off the excess fluid.
Okay, let's talk about infections. Otitis media, every parent knows this one.
Middle ear infection. Very common in kids because their eustachian tubes are shorter, flatter, and wider, allowing throat bacteria to travel up easily.
The kid is pulling on their ear, crying, has a fever.
The eardrum looks red and bulging when you look with an otoscope.
Mm-hmm.
We treat with antibiotics. If it's chronic, they might do a myringotomy.
That's the tubes.
Yes. They make a tiny incision in the eardrum to drain the fluid and insert a pressure equalizing tube.
And a key teaching point.
Those tubes are designed to fall out eventually. If a parent finds a tiny plastic spool on the pillow 6 months later, that's normal. It means the ear healed and pushed it out. Don't panic.
Now, what is the dangerous complication of ear infections?
Mastoiditis.
This is when the infection leaves the ear.
It spreads to the mastoid bone, that hard, bony bump right behind your earlobe.
Why is that such a big deal?
The mastoid bone is porous, like a honeycomb, and it sits millimeters away from the brain. If the infection eats through that bone, it can cause meningitis or a brain abscess.
That's life-threatening. How do I spot it?
Look behind the ear. If the skin over the mastoid bone is red, swollen, or tender to the touch, that is a major red flag. The ear itself might be pushed forward by the swelling.
Swelling behind the ear equals call the provider immediately.
Yes. They need IV antibiotics and possibly surgery, a mastoidectomy, to scrape out the infected bone.
One more infection type, swimmer's ear. External otitis.
This is an infection of the skin of the ear canal itself. It's very painful, but there's a physical exam trick to diagnose it.
How do you tell the difference between middle ear otitis media and outer ear external otitis?
You touch the ear, grab the top part, or the tragus, the little bump in front, and whittle it.
Wiggle the ear.
If the patient jumps off the table in pain, it's external otitis. The canal is inflamed, so moving the ear hurts. If it's a middle ear infection, wiggling the outer ear usually doesn't hurt as much because the infection is deep behind the drum.
Wiggle pain equals swimmer's ear. Got it. Now let's get technical with skills. Administering drugs. This seems simple, but the NCLEX gets very specific about direction.
Because the anatomy changes with age. The ear canal is curved. To get drops to the bottom, we have to straighten the canal.
What's the rule?
For adults and children over 3, pull the pinna up and back.
Up because adults are tall.
That works. Up and back. For children under 3, you pull down and back. Down, because they are short.
Okay. Up and back for adults. And temperature.
Critical safety point. Ear drops must be room temperature.
Why?
If you squirt cold fluid into the ear canal, it shocks the vestibular nerve. It causes the caloric response, severe vertigo, and vomiting immediately.
You could make the patient throw up just by using cold drops.
Yes. Warm the bottle in your hands for a minute first.
Eye drops. We talked about punctal occlusion. Where do we aim?
Never aim at the cornea, the clear part over the iris. It's super sensitive and you'll trigger a blink reflex. You aim for the conjunctival sac.
The pocket inside the lower lid.
Pull the lower lid down, have the patient look up, and drop it in the pocket.
And sterility.
Do not let the tip of the bottle touch the eye, the lashes, or the skin. If it touches, the bottle is contaminated. Throw it out.
And if I have 2 drops due at 0 and 900?
Wait 3 to 5 minutes between them. If you do them back to back, the second drop just washes the first one out.
Drops versus ointment.
Drops first, ointment last. Ointment is greasy, and it blocks the absorption of anything you put in after it.
Last skill. Irrigation for wax removal.
Step 1. Check history. If they have a perforated eardrum or a history of perforation, stop. Do not irrigate. You'll wash bacteria right into the middle ear.
Assuming the drum is intact.
Use warm water again. Avoid vertigo. Direct the stream toward the wall of the canal, usually the top wall.
Don't aim at the blockage.
No. If you aim at the wax plug, you might just push it deeper. You want the water to go past the wax, hit the wall, turn around, and push the wax out from behind. Also, never aim directly at the eardrum, or you could rupture it with the pressure.
Aim at the wall. Stop if it hurts.
Immediately.
We have covered a massive amount of ground. Pathophysiology, drugs, surgeries, safety skills. I think it's time to put our listeners to the test.
I'm ready. Let's do some rapid-fire scenarios.
I'm going to give you a clinical situation. You tell me the action and the rationale.
Let's go.
Scenario 1. You are caring for a client with a history of glaucoma. They are scheduled for a colonoscopy. The pre-op order set includes atropine to dry up secretions. Do you give the med?
No. You hold the med and contact the provider. Rationale. Atropine is an anticholinergic midriatic. It dilates the pupil, which can obstruct the outflow of aqueous humor and precipitate an acute angle closure glaucoma attack.
Perfect. Scenario 2. You are in the PCU with a patient who just had cataract surgery on their right eye. They are vomiting and complaining of severe pain in that right eye.
Emergency. Notify the surgeon immediately. Rationale. Severe pain and vomiting are signs of increased intraocular pressure or hemorrhage. This puts the surgical site at risk of rupture. Normal post-op pain should be mild.
Exactly. Scenario 3. A patient comes in with a chemical splash to the eye. They are frantic. They want you to check if they are blind.
Action. Ignore the request for a vision check. Begin irrigation immediately. Rationale. Time is tissue. Every second the chemical remains, it burns deeper. Irrigate for 20 minutes before doing any assessment.
Priority action. Love it. Scenario 4. You have a patient taking high-dose aspirin for rheumatoid arthritis. They mention they hear a buzzing sound in their ears constantly.
Action. Withhold the next dose and contact the provider. Rationale. Tinnitus is the first sign of ototoxicity from salicylates. Continuing the aspirin could lead to permanent hearing loss.
Nailed it. Last one. Scenario 5. You enter the room of a patient with Meniere's disease. They're lying in bed, eyes closed. The TV is on loud, and the fluorescent overhead lights are on.
Action. Turn off the TV, dim the lights, and ensure side rails are up. Rationale. During a Meniere's attack, external stimuli noise, bright lights exacerbate the vertigo. You need to create a quiet, dark, safe environment.
You nailed them. These are the patterns, aren't they? It's not about knowing every obscure disease. It's about recognizing safety and pressure.
Exactly. If you filter every eye ear question through, is the pressure too high or is the patient safe from falling? It's not getting 90% of them right.
Let's wrap this up with a final recap. The don't forget this on NCLEX list.
Number 1, the glaucoma rules. It's a plumbing problem. Miotics constrict open the drain. Beta blockers turn off the faucet. And atropine, which dilates, is forbidden.
Number 2, post-op eye safety. No bending, no lifting, no straining. Prevent IOP spikes at all costs. Constipation is the enemy. Number three, the red flags. Severe pain after eye surgery is bad. Swelling behind the ear, that's mastoiditis, is bad. A sudden fixed and dilated pupil is bad.
Number four, retinal detachment, flashes, floaters, curtain. It's painless, and you patch both eyes to stop movement.
Number five, ear safety. No cold drops that causes vomiting. No irrigation if the eardrum is perforated. And remember, up and back for adults.
And let's add two more. Number six, communication. Don't shout. Face the patient, lower your pitch.
And finally, number seven, the don't touch it rule. Penetrating object. Leave it alone. Stabilize it with a cup. Call the pros.
That list covers the high-yield content right there.
You know, sensory disorders can feel overwhelming because there is a lot of anatomy, but if you step back, it really comes down to quality of life and safety.
It does. We are the guardians of their senses. If we mess up the drops or miss the pressure spike, they lose the ability to see their grandkids or hear music. It's high stakes.
But it's manageable stakes if you know your stuff. And remember, repetition is key. You aren't going to memorize all of this in one listen. That's why resources like nursingnotes.org are so helpful.
Absolutely. I have to mention the music-powered learning again. I know we joked about up and back, but setting these rules to a melody really makes them sticky. It uses a different part of your brain. It's the first and only resource that uses music to help you memorize more.
It really does. And the AI tools to generate quizzes based on your weak spots, like if you keep missing the glaucoma meds, are a total game changer. It's all built by nurses who have been exactly where you are right now.
Nurses who have conquered the NCLEX, and you will too.
So take a deep breath. You know more than you think you do. Focus on safety. Focus on the why.
Keep studying. Stay confident.
And go crush that test. Thanks for listening to ConceptCast. We'll see you in the next deep dive.